Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is your host Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Council. As a part of our new mini-series around investor due diligence for minerals and royalties funds, I had Roger Crabb, partner at Chief & Stone Law Firm, onto the podcast. During the episode, Roger walks through the various aspects of raising a fund, including the role of registered investment advisors and broker-dealers, investment structure, and due diligence checklists. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Roger had to say.
Roger, good morning. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for taking time to do this.
Absolutely. Good morning, Sam.
We're excited to have you part of our investor due diligence mini-series here for minerals and royalties companies who are out there who are fundraising, actively managing funds. And I think you're going to have a lot of great insights to bring to the table. Before we jump into the weeds, a little background on yourself, your experience in oil and gas, who Chief & Stone is. I'll let you take it from here just to give everyone some context.
Sure. And so I've been practicing law since 84. Started with a large law firm here in Dallas, went to a second firm after a couple of years, and then I was recruited to go in-house with a major oil and gas company by the name of Triton Energy. Triton Energy has since been bought, I think, twice over now, but I was there from 88 to 93, and they recruited me for my corporate and my finance and my M&A expertise. There was another attorney that did the pure oil and gas, but I did all the transactions, whether it was a financing, whether it was an acquisition, whether it was a disposition, and all the corporate work, the SEC work. And so as a consequence of that, I had to get very, very deep in the industry. And I knew virtually everybody in the company, the geologists, the geophysicists, the pure oil and gas folks on the production side, on the pipeline side. And so got to know the business, got to love the business. And being here in Texas, it's hard not to touch the oil and gas business at some point or another. Sure. So I was with them for 5 years, jump forward about 15, 20 years. I had a chance to come back into private practice and I came into Chief & Stone. It's a firm of about 60 plus attorneys now. Most of the attorneys came from large firm backgrounds, but choose to practice in a different setting. It's a very collegial setting and I feel very fortunate to be there. In my practice now, because of my exposure to oil and gas, I do a ton of oil and gas work, everything from offerings to M&A transactions, working interest offerings, mineral interest offerings, royalty offerings. So our firm and I in particular touch the industry on a regular basis, virtually daily, matter of fact.
When we spoke before this, Roger, you had talked about your minerals clients and what you've done historically in the mineral space with Chief & Stone. You said a lot of your clients are doing 10 to 15 million-ish size range funds or partnerships, which I think is fantastic. It's the lion's share of the minerals universe, right? You do have much larger funds. They tend to be private equity if they're 100 plus million. You do have some family offices, institutional funds that get up in, you know, the 50, 100 plus range, but a large majority are high net worth, friends and family, you know, family office funds that are 10 to 15 million. Now, when you talk about AUM, these funds can repeat themselves and you go back out, you fundraise again and you do iteration 2, 3, 4, 5, et cetera. And you have quite a bit of money under management. But I think you're going to speak to a large part of our audience today in terms of the size of the fund. And I'd like to start to break it down a little bit. If anyone wants to go out there and raise money direct, you know, some of the things they should look out for, regulatory compliance, so on and so forth. We'll get into all that over the discussion. I guess the one thing, let's start with just a very basic question. Do you have to be an SEC registered broker dealer or have some sort of licensing to raise money direct? I'll let you kick it off with that question.
The answer is no. So several of our clients are, again, they're private companies. They don't do anything special with the SEC other than take advantage of the Regulation D exemption. And so as long as it's an officer or director of the company that's actually undertaking the sales, they can claim the exemption, but they don't have to be a registered broker dealer. That's very, very clear. There's a lot of misunderstanding about that in the marketplace, actually.
One of the reasons we're doing this little mini-series, Roger, is there's going to be a lot of first-time funds out there in the next few years. Folks that were, you know, basically doing friends and family or flipping stuff with their own money, or went private equity and now need to go direct. They have a track record, but not of managing funds. Reg D exemption, just expand on that briefly, just to educate everyone who's starting to do their homework around this space.
Sure. So I'll back up just a little bit. Yeah, any interest in oil and gas generally is treated as a security, both for federal and state law. And so the sale of security has to be either a registered offering or an offering pursuant to an exemption. And the most common exemption that issuers avail themselves of is called Reg D or Regulation D. It's rules 501 through 507 or 8 of under the 33 Act. And Regulation D, Rule 506 in particular, is the one that issuers most often avail themselves of. And it enables issuers to sell an unlimited number of securities to an unlimited number of investors. There's actually, they can take up to 35 unaccredited investors, but none of our clients takes advantage of that because we advise very strongly against dealing with unaccredited investors who are folks that typically don't have the income or the net worth to suggest they have some sophistication in their decision-making process.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to let you know that the Minerals and Royalties Council will be hosting our in-person North Am Royalties Assembly in Houston on October 13th. As a part of the agenda, we're going to have a panel discussion around fundraising in the minerals and royalties space with confirmed speakers Jacob Nagy, co-CEO of Avant Natural Resources, Oliver Jenkins, President and COO of Phillips Energy, and Troy Eckerd, CEO of Eckerd Land and Acquisitions. If you're interested in participating in this event, either with ticket registration, speaking, and or sponsorship, then please email me at tim.powell@energycouncil.com. Thanks. Now let's jump back into the episode. And an accredited investor, is the definition $250,000 per investment, or is it total net worth? What is the defining mechanism there around accredited investors? And then, you know, going forward too, some of the things you can do to confirm that they're accredited investors. I know that some of our clients have asked for third-party verification. This kind of goes into the latter part of our discussion around due diligence. But yeah, accredited investors, talk about that space a little bit.
Okay, so first of all, the SEC broadened the definition this past fall. And so there are more kind of categories of accredited investor. But I want to just speak to basically to the two primary definitions that most issuers avail of. And it's people who have either $1 million net worth without taking into account their house, okay? And if their house happens to be upside down vis-a-vis their mortgage, then that little delta is netted against $1 million, okay, or whatever the net worth otherwise be. So they've got to have a clean $1 million net worth, or there's an income test, $200,000 per year for each of the last 2 years, and a prospect of that same number in the current year. And if they want to aggregate their income with their spouse, that number in all cases rises to $300,000. So if they meet either of those two financial tests, then they are accredited. Now, before we jump forward there, I advise, because of the nature of oil and gas, on kind of a scale of 1 to 10, oil and gas generally is on the higher end of the scale. So all of our clients, literally without exception, they do a investor qualification process, much like broker-dealers do, where they've got know your customer requirements. So we put together and help our clients with a qualification questionnaire where they ask questions that prompt answers about risk tolerance, other investments they're engaged in, how much of their total net worth is involved in this investment, that type of thing. So our client can actually make a decision, yes, this is an appropriate investment for this particular individual. And some of our clients will actually turn down investors, which I like to see, so that they don't deal with folks that don't have the sophistication necessary to absorb the risk of an oil and gas investment. So this qualification process they go through, and it's not just filling in some blanks on a document. Our clients actually speak to these folks a few times as well to really get a sense of them. And I think in those conversations, they ferret out some of that information to make sure, again, that the investment and that the individual are truly qualified for a relatively higher risk type of investment.
What about minimum investment into a fund? Is there guidelines around that or recommendations? A lot of times what I see with clients is a minimum of either a quarter of a million or a half a million. It seems pretty standard. Is that an indirect way to basically qualify someone as a serious investor, or are there actual regulations around the minimum size in an offering?
There's actually no law, no regulations that specify a minimum. But to your suggestion, Tim, most of my clients do have a fairly high minimum. They will sometimes, if there's a series of offerings, they might lower the minimum for prior investors, okay? But ordinarily, I see anywhere from 50 to 100 to 250 minimums. And a lot of times, that kind of narrows the field, so to speak, with people. It's kind of an indirect way of qualifying folks. If they can afford that much money in a single investment, that lends credence to what they say elsewhere about their risk tolerance and so forth.
No, that's perfect. So dialing it back then to the original question. So you don't need to be a registered investment advisor or have any sort of SEC licensing to raise money. But then why would someone use a registered broker dealer? You know, I think the misconception for a lot of folks is you need them from a regulatory compliance standpoint to raise capital, but it really is more of an access thing and tapping into just a broader range of investors, correct? Can you expand upon that?
Well, yes. To your first question, it's not required to be a registered broker dealer. It's not required to use a registered broker dealer. We have one client that has done probably well over a dozen offerings, and they like going through registered broker dealers because the broker dealer that they use is qualified in virtually every state. And so they have this broad range of clients all over the country. The registered broker dealer, they have multiple folks on their staff. They will themselves take the time to get up to speed on what it is that's being sold. And they have that heavy regulatory overlay anyway, so it almost requires that they really get up to speed thoroughly on what it is they're selling and be able to answer questions knowledgeably and so forth. But it's really most function of broadening access. The other help is when you're buying royalties, or if an investor is going to invest in royalties or mineral interests, there's just a basic level of understanding that needs to be achieved on the part of the investor before they feel comfortable investing. Oil and gas is not an intuitive type of thing that people just understand it easily. A lot of times it'll take some explanation, maybe some graphics, literally some pictures of what's going on above ground and below ground, and they can describe the different interests and so forth. And so if our client can basically multiply himself 50 times and have brokers all over the country helping to explain this, it works wonders. And he does that not only through a single broker's relationship, but by going to conferences periodically and speaking and educating the broker's community generally on what mineral interests are, what royalty interests are, to hopefully spark some interest on the part of the broker's community. And so our client has been very successful. They sell almost exclusively, this one particular client in the royalties and mineral interest business sells almost exclusively through the brokerage community.
Yeah, and broker-dealers, this is another misconception that I hear a lot, is broker-dealers, are more used for retail, but broker-dealers can be used to, you know, get in the door with institutional capital, family offices, right? It covers the whole spectrum, wouldn't you concur?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Well, excellent. Well, so whether you use a broker-dealer or not, you have a client that approaches you, they're looking to raise, let's arbitrarily call it $15 million. Let's talk about structure and the different types of things you've seen with clients, the things that maybe we can do a pros and cons of, or the different things to consider when you're looking at, you know, partnerships, you know, pools of capital where your investors are taking their interest undivided, GPLP structures and the variants that are around that. Another thing I'd love to touch upon is trust, which is a major part of this space. We've done podcasts before where best estimates are that 10 to 11% of the minerals in the United States sit within trust. So I believe you have some background on trust formation. Would love for you to just talk about structure and what you've seen, what you've worked on over your career as it pertains to minerals.
Okay, sure. So I can say that the minority of the structures involve the creation of an entity, whether it's an LLC or a limited liability company or an LP, a limited partnership. And then the investors are offered ownership interests, equity interests in those entities. And so they track the ownership in those entities. But a lot of times those entities they're set up so that there will be, let's say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years hence, there'll be a liquidation of the entity. And so regardless of what's happening to the underlying assets, the minerals or the royalties, there's a liquidation of those interests. And the sponsor, the manager, if you will, of the LLC or of the LP will take it upon himself to do his best to try to turn those interests to cash, okay? And failing the ability to do that, will distribute those interests in kind to the investors, okay? What I see more often is an LLC is created, or it could be an LP is created, but the investors don't own interest in the entity. What the entity does, it aggregates pools, if you will, a variety of royalty interests or mineral interests. And then what it offers to the investors is undivided slices, if you will, fractional interests in that pool of royalties. And so the investor owns those interests directly, okay? In fact, there's a title document that's actually created and sent to the investor and filed in the deed records where oil and gas ownership records are maintained. And then the investor owns that permanently. It's literally a permanent interest. And some investors might want to buy that and pass it on to their kids. It becomes a matter of legacy, and they'll invest several times. But each time they invest in that pool of royalties or pool of mineral interests, they already have what I call kind of a portfolio effect in doing so. On your question of trust, I don't get involved in the creation of trust. I have a tax partner that does that. But I have noticed that some trusts are typically set up for family planning and estate planning purposes do come in and make acquisitions of fractional interest in these pools, or they come in and buy interest in the entities that own the assets. And they're used, I've seen a lot, for estate planning purposes. I've also seen, Tim, instances where a trust will come to our client and say, we have $5 million. Can you just put together a pool of royalties for us? And it'd be kind of a one-off thing. And of course, our client will always accommodate that request as well.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to Noble Royalties for sponsoring our Minerals and Royalties podcast. As a leader in the minerals and royalties space since 1997, Noble remains committed to creative solutions for others who may be rethinking their risk tolerance. In order to adjust to the current market cycle, Noble thinks it might be time to reset, rethink, and redeploy capital differently. If you're interested in exploring ways to work with Noble, then please give Chase Morris a call at 972-788-5823 or email him at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com. I also want to thank Enverus, a leading energy SaaS company that has software platforms designed to empower oil and gas companies through analytics and highly technical insights. MineralSoft is Enverus's mineral management platform that enables owners to capture missing revenue and maximize the value of their minerals portfolios. EnergyLink is Enverus's platform for automating joint venture and owner relations business processes. If you're interested in learning more about Enverus, MineralSoft, and EnergyLink, then please visit www.enverus.com or email businessdevelopment@enverus.com. Thanks. Now let's jump back into the episode.
From a reporting standpoint, or just when you're looking at the majority of what you see at the lower end of the market here, these partnerships, the LLCs that pull these interests together, is it more onerous to have the undivided interests cut up and the deeds go direct to the individual shareholders versus dividend payments? Is it relatively similar, or just a different type of paperwork? I'm just curious, for folks who are looking at various structures before they get into the weeds, what can they expect when looking at the various alternatives?
Well, I don't think either structure is onerous to either the issuer or the prospective investor here, to be real honest, Tim. I personally like for investors to have the interest directly. There's no exposure, there's no liability exposure to an investor that flows as a consequence of ownership of either minerals or of royalties. There's no like drilling obligations, there's no contingent liabilities. And so having an entity involved, so we're comparing against direct ownership in a pool of interest or ownership in an entity. the investors don't really need that entity there to serve as a liability shield. So I think that that's part of your question. In any event, in either structure, the investors are going to want an entity there, whether they invest through the entity or they invest directly in the pool, and the entity is there to help them with the mechanics and the accounting and so forth, because there's a function, it's a management function that is served by the issuer, because they get all these checks from all these different operating companies, these drillers, division orders, and the checks. The interests that are owned, these royalty interests, are very, very, in very, very large wells, Tim. Sometimes these fractional interests are like 0.00001 interest of a royalty interest, but it has an incredible amount of value because of the magnitude of the well or the magnitude of the field. And so someone who maintains all of that accounting is very helpful. But it's not, I wouldn't use the word onerous either for the investor or for the issuer. It's really just a matter of personal choice. Again, I prefer the direct interest, because you have assurance, you as the investor have assurance that you're going to own that forever, literally forever.
So let's now walk across the other side of the table and put ourselves in the shoes of the investor. I'd love for you to walk through a due diligence checklist, if you may, that an investor, an investment advisor can look at when they're looking to enter into a prospective minerals fund or minerals, you know, LLC pool structure. The idea being, if there is a first-time fund, whether it's really raising capital and managing stuff for the first time, or someone who has a private equity background that's raising money for the first time, let's assume good faith, everyone's doing things the right way. We want investors to get comfortable if they're doing the right things. And we also want the minerals companies, the professionals out there who are pursuing to raise money for funds, to make sure they're doing the right things to get investors comfortable. So kind of serving two purposes here. But what are some of the things that investors should look for and what minerals execs should do to get everyone comfortable so that things are compliant, above board, et cetera, et cetera? Can you walk through some things you've seen and some things you recommend to clients?
You bet. And again, my practice has always been on the issuer side, but what we try to do is provide as much information as possible so that investors don't have to make any extraordinary efforts in their diligence. But if I were representing an investor, I would want to focus on two things primarily. And before I address those, you know, investors will want to get comfortable with management and so forth, their historical record, but I would focus on two things: ownership of the minerals and the royalties, and the money. Okay, so the minerals first. Again, minerals, oil and gas interests are deeded interests. The ownership is actually reflected in public records. Every county, for instance, here in the state of Texas, and I suspect it's likewise elsewhere, has traditional real estate records, ownership like of your home, but there's a whole separate set of public records that deals with oil and gas interests, mineral interests. And so it would not be an imposition for an investor to ask the issuer, let me see the records that you've got. Let me see the records that you've used in the past on other offerings. Let me see those filings. And let me talk to a geologist on your staff, or a geologist that you use on a contract basis, to understand what it is you got. The other thing that I would ask for is typically, and the issuers will have something akin to a map, if you will. And you imagine looking at a map, let's say, of two or three areas in the Anadarko region of Oklahoma. There are two or three or four counties there have a lot of activity. I would want to see a map that shows all of the wells that are currently being drilled, and where the mineral interests reside in that set of wells. And then again, the underlying records to show the ownership. Okay. So then now you, the investor, have that confidence that, yeah, they actually own what it is they say they're own. Okay. Then I would also focus on the money. Okay. I would want to see how they get their funds from the operators, the Devon Energies, the Continentals, the Shells of the world, and how those funds are treated, how they're distributed, and have a demonstration, if you will, of what is was happened with prior offerings, so that there's some assurance that the money is coming in, is going out the way it's supposed to. And none of that should be difficult for an issuer. It literally pushes a couple buttons on a computer with some of the software packages that they use out there, and they can demonstrate very, very simply that the funds are coming in and going out the way they should. I focus on the ownership of the asset and what's happening to the money. Show me the money.
You had mentioned to me in a prior conversation hiring a forensic auditor on previous funds to check out, you know, all the things you basically just mentioned and make sure everything's legitimate, make sure there's no conflicts of interest, make sure returns aren't inflated, right? Are they buying from related entities? It just flushes out all potential illegalities. It's really the responsibility of the issuer to hire these types of third-party auditors, advisors, et cetera, and then having them provided to an investor so that it's a clean and simple, you know, due diligence process for them, correct? The onus is not on the investor to go out and hire these people, that, unless I'm mistaken.
No, you have that right, Tim. The issuer should do basically whatever it takes to provide information to the investor so the investor can make what I call a fully informed decision. And that puts the investor's mind at ease on any aspect of the offering that might be potentially troublesome. Accredited investors, they all have their individual hot buttons. Some like management. Some want to focus on the underlying assets. Some want to focus on the flow of the funds. But whatever that is, the issuer should undertake whatever efforts are necessary to put the investor's mind at ease.
You had also mentioned having a secondary set of advisors verify the work of, call it the primary advisors, to, you know, make sure there's that extra check mark, that extra set of eyes, and then also perform their own due diligence and bring up things that may have been missed. Is that always recommended? Is there a certain fund size where those extra fees start to justify themselves? I mean, I think the challenge, at least in the conversations I have, is how many advisors do you hire? What kind of costs do you take on? That all pushes down returns, right? Bring on those costs, but you don't want to, there's the fine line of the cost of doing business and providing everything that's needed and cutting corners that can potentially get you in trouble or lose the confidence of investors. What do you advise, especially the lower size funds that you typically focus on versus a $100 million or a $500 million or $1 billion fund? We're talking private equity, where you can pay for all this stuff, right? Because you need to, and it's just so much capital under management.
Right, understood. So the clients that I deal with, and that's a great question, Tim, because if an issuer spends a lot basically hiring advisors, hiring auditors, and so forth, it could push down the returns on a particular fund. But what I advise my clients to do is don't push all of those costs through the next fund. You know, you should absorb some of those in your overhead and parse those out over the next 3, 4, 5 funds so that you're not penalizing, if you will, the first offering after which you've engaged those advisors, those professionals. You're not punishing the first fund's yield simply because you've made an extraordinary effort. And the flip of that is everybody else should get a free ride. You know, the future offerings that have the benefit of that same level of scrutiny, that those second or third or fourth sets of eyes, those folks should also, if you will, absorb some of the cost of that extra diligence that an issuer imposes upon itself. So that's the best answer to your question, and that's precisely, it was a great question, it's precisely what I advise our clients to do. In this area, in particular, you know, the geologists, and if you know the difference between a geologist and a geophysicist, but those folks, they don't come cheap. The good ones don't come cheap. And so there should be ready access to a rock star geologist who's familiar with the particular geographic, geologic area in which the interests are focused. Because what we see here is, let's say in a royalties offering, there'll be 1, 2, primary 3 areas max where the royalties originate from. And they tend to be associated with very, very major formations, oil and gas formations as well. They're not minor formations.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to Noble Royalties for sponsoring our Minerals and Royalties podcast. As a leader in the minerals and royalties space since 1997,
Noble remains committed to creative solutions for others who may be rethinking their risk tolerance. In order to adjust to the current market cycle, Noble thinks it might be time to reset, rethink, and redeploy capital differently. If you're interested in exploring ways to work with Noble, then please give Chase Morris a call at 972-788-5823 or email him at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com. I also want to thank Enverus, a leading energy SaaS company that has software platforms designed to empower oil and gas companies through analytics and highly technical insights. MineralSoft is Enverus's mineral management platform that enables owners to capture missing revenue and maximize the value of their minerals portfolios. EnergyLink is Enverus's platform for automating joint venture and owner relations business processes. If you're interested in learning more about Enverus, MineralSoft, and EnergyLink, then please visit www.enverus.com or email businessdevelopment@enverus.com. Thanks. Now let's jump back into the episode.
I think one of the punchlines, and this has come up in some other episodes we're doing in this miniseries, is that it's really important to hire advisors that have the expertise in their particular field, whether it be on the legal side, the auditing side, et cetera, but also have the oil and gas expertise in-house, because combining those two is what's needed for this. You know, just to use accounting as an example, if you just have a general accountant, you know, oil and gas accounting and then fund accounting, totally different skill sets. And so one of the things that's been recommended is if you just have regular in-house counsel or regular in-house accounting, and you think you're going to then transition into raising and managing a fund, very likely you can negligently, you know, get yourself into some trouble, because what you don't know what you don't know. And it's really important to get on the right people on your team so that you can stay compliant and in line with everything to service your investor clients. And that has to be the same with the advisors you're hiring, because you want specialists that you can ensure, again, to investors to put their minds at ease, right?
Absolutely. I fully agree with everything you just stated.
And one other thing I found interesting, Roger, you had talked about, and these are probably for very special situations, or if it's a large investment for an individual, but hiring private investigators and doing background checks on someone before you invest in them. And that's something you said you've recommended clients to do in the past. Expand upon that a little bit. And again, this kind of goes down to the due diligence checklist, as we're calling it.
Well, I've used this in a couple different settings. If we have a brand new oil and gas issuer that, in fact, I've got one this week, matter of fact, I interviewed him last week, just as a matter of diligence as a law firm, knowing our own clients, okay, we will sometimes do somewhat of a background check to understand that make sure that we're representing somebody who's competent and has integrity and has not been guilty of any faux pas in the past, whether it's a regulatory issue, a lawsuit, investor complaints. And there's some diligence we can do on our own. If we need to supplement that, we will hire a private investigator and spend the $500 or $1,000 or whatever it costs to do a quick background check. I've also advised a client in past instances to do the same thing. It's not expensive, surprisingly so. People don't realize how inexpensive it can be to do a background check and just ferret out information that can't be easily located on an internet search. And that's very helpful, just to have that additional piece of information about someone, so you know that you're actually dealing with someone who is what they say they are.
No, that's a great, I appreciate you bringing that up. I'm actually surprised, as you say that, how cheap that is, right? So sometimes there's reluctance to do certain things in fear that, oh, it's too expensive. And matter of fact, if you're going to be investing hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, it's a non-factor, right? Just to make sure you know what you're getting into. So,
absolutely.
Well, very good, Roger. I've really enjoyed this. Some fantastic information, a wealth of knowledge. It's something that's a bit different in terms of content and what we usually bring to the table here in the podcast. And we're bringing it because we know it'll add value to the folks out there that want to raise funds directly. So I really appreciate your time. Floor is over to you just to close it out with any comments, messages to investors, the industry, anything about Chief and Stone. I'll let you take it away.
Sure. So again, I think part of the lesson here is just know it is who you're dealing with. Do follow your gut, and from an investor standpoint, from an issuer standpoint, either one. If it's an issuer, just be able and be ready to demonstrate historical performance, historical records as far as what is owned. Make it easy for investors to track how the funds flow, and that you should be very successful here.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Roger. Have a wonderful rest of your morning and week, and we'll be in touch.
Very good, sir. Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties Council represents the largest network of senior minerals and royalties-focused executives and investors in the world. Throughout the year, we leverage our relationships and industry knowledge to facilitate introductions on behalf of our royalties clients to help them place capital, buy and sell deals, and form new partnerships. If you're interested in learning more about how we can help your team, then please email me at tim.powell@energycouncil.com. or visit our website at www.energycouncil.com/minerals-royalties-council/. Also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and be sure to share these episodes with anyone in your network that you think would enjoy. Thanks, and see you next time.